Greetings. Welcome to another Truth Factor discussion. We'd like to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us as we study through the book of Ecclesiastes. We have been looking at this now for probably about a month and a half, maybe a hair bit longer, but we're not too far away from the end of it. We'll be picking up in chapter 9, verse 7 here in just a couple of moments. Now, if you have any questions or comments you'd like to throw our way, we would invite you to do so. You can use the comment section that is connected to this live video on our Facebook page, which is Truth Factor Live, or you can use the chat area on our YouTube channel where we're also live streaming, and that is also at Truth Factor Live. You can also send us emails and stuff like that. Let me bring that up here, and I just made myself disappear. Let's do it like this. Sorry about that. There we go. You can send us email questions at truthfactorlive.com, and we'll get those also. So let me go ahead and bring everyone into our discussion today. Gentlemen, how are y'all doing this morning? Everybody fine?
Doing good.
Dandy?
Doing great. Yep.
Paul doing stepping good. Into a backup field as a plumber?
Yeah. That would not be good.
No, I hear you. I understand. All right, let's see. Who do we have joining us today so far? At least those who've chimed in. And if you don't want to make your presence known in the comment section or chat room, that's fine too. But we have Eileen. Am I saying that right, Brian?
Eileen.
Okay. All right. Emphasis on Al.
Eileen.
Yeah. Eileen. We have Michael Davis with us and others. You know, if you've joined us, we'd like to thank you so much. But let's go ahead and jump right into our study today. And as I said a while ago, we're picking up in Ecclesiastes chapter 9, there in verse 7. And we're kind of in the middle of the chapter here, but I think this would be a good start point. And so what we'll do is, Brian, let me go ahead and throw it to you. And if you would, read for us verses, 7 through 10. 7 through 10.
Okay, so I'll be reading Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verses 7 through 10. I'll be reading from the New King James Version. Go eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your works. Let your garments always be white. Let your head lack no oil. Live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life, which he has given you under the sun, all your days of vanity. For that is your portion in life, and in labor you perform under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. For there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you are going.
All righty. Let's see. Still getting I've made some few changes, so I'm still getting the hang of a couple of things here real quick. Going back here to verse number 7, starting in the section here. So in the previous section, he's talked about what basically is the idea of death comes to everybody. You know, no matter what you do, rich or poor, smart, dumb, it doesn't matter, you know, or I should say intelligent or lacking intelligence. Everybody still dies in the end. So when you look at this section, Brian, starting in verse 7, what's he telling you to do?
Well, you know, let me say it first. You might look at this and say it almost sounds like he's being sarcastic. Just enjoy your life because you're going to die. But I think actually we're getting a New Testament message here. And let me kind of give you the characteristic that I think we might be seeing here in verses 7 through 10. If we contrast this section of the reading with a big part of the message in the book of Ephesians. So in the book of Ephesians, the Apostle Paul says that we are, in chapter 2, he says we are God's workmanship and that we were created for works which he prepared before. I just got the passage all mixed up, which he prepared ahead of time. So the things that God has prepared us to work. Well, verse 7 here, he says, God's already accepted your works. In other words, your works, I might see this as a parallel to that statement. Your works, the things that your life is expected by God, are prepared ahead of time. Now, in Ephesians, Paul then goes on to describe the works that were prepared beforehand when he starts talking in chapter 4 and 5 about righteous conduct. But then at the end of chapter 5, he talks about husbands and wives, parents and children. In chapter 6, employees, employers, work. Well, that's actually what we're talking about here, where he says, number one, you know, live joyfully with your wife that you love. Well, husbands love your wives, you know, wives submit to your husbands. He says, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. In fact, you probably have a cross reference there that takes you over to either Colossians or Ephesians to say, whatever you do in word or in deed, do all in the name of the Lord. I don't think this is a statement of, you know, life is vain, you know, why does any of it matter? I think this might be a contrast with what Paul would say in Ephesians, that, hey, God has things that you need to be about. You need to be about those. And life is vain, again, because in the perspective of the writer, if we haven't yet, you know, grasped the idea of who God is and what he has plans for us, which is the last verse of the book, talks about, you know, the idea of a resurrection, the idea of an eternal judgment, but he won't mention it until then. So if without that, we have a sense of vanity, but he is saying there's an expectation from God. And that expectation is that I live, maybe 1 Peter chapter 3, you know, to dwell in an understanding way with your wife. It might be a contrast to verse 9 too, but these are all New Testament statements, I think. And so it's kind of interesting to look at this passage and say, you know, perhaps what we're getting here is a good New Testament description of how it is and what God expects of people.
Okay. It's a good explanation. Any thoughts?
I thought Brian did a real nice job with that, because I do think probably in this section, there's a statement that we read, like some of us who major in sarcasm would say a certain way. And I think it's in verse 9. Enjoy your life with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life. I think we kind of pile on there. And I thought Brian did a nice job of saying probably in this writing, he's not saying it just for that kind of snarkiness that we might be accustomed to in our culture, but just that a reality there and where our focus needs to be and what's really important. So I appreciated what Brian had to say there.
Okay.
And you know, following up, as you mentioned right at the beginning of this, John, you know, this comes on the heels of one of Solomon's many admonitions about death, you know, and which is why life is vain and so on. But yet I do kind of see in this, you know, don't let that keep you from, you know, don't let that keep you from doing what you can do. And enjoying to the best of your ability, whatever it is. I mean, and again, I agree with the idea. I don't think there's so much the sarcasm here. I mean, the idea of your life is going to end, but in the meantime, you know what? If you're married, enjoy your wife. You know, make the best of what you have for as long as you have it. And I think that's one of the driving points home, you know, that whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. You know, do what you can now while you know you can.
Yeah, that's a good point. One thing to note is in the English Standard Version, there in verse number 10, it uses the latter part of it, it says, for there's no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol to which you are going. And the New King James Version, it says the grave. And that kind of goes back to what we've talked about before. What Solomon is talking about when it comes to the physical things terminating, ceasing to exist, of no longer benefit, he talks like once you die, there is then nothing else that remains. But he's talking very physically. You know, it's not so much his discussion there to talk about spiritually. You know, that's in a broader picture here that he's looking at. Okay, any other thoughts? All right, let me get back to the right translation here real quick. Let's go forward now. In the next section, then, let's go ahead, I guess, read through the end of the chapter there, taking verses 11 through 17. It's not a good little batch. Are we missing any comments yet? All right, if you see a comment come across, guys, just holler at me and just let me know there.
John, one thought here is, and I don't want to just delay moving on, but verse 8, let your garments always be white, I think white is generally a symbol of purity.
you know, keep your life pure. So he's not saying, you know, your life's just vain, you know, do whatever. I think it's a symbol of purity. From what I understand, in ancient culture, they would do anointment daily unless they were in mourning. And so let not your oil be lacking on your head. Live a life of joy and pleasantness and enjoy what this life has to offer. He includes within that the wife and talk about there's an old American proverb, I guess, that's if anything's worth doing, it's worth doing well. And here he says, whatever your hands find to do, do it with your might. Enjoy doing those things that are successful. And so just a thought. And I'm not opposed to moving on. So
it's a good point. Good point. Okay. All right. Well, then, Paul, let me throw it back to you. And would you read for us 11 through 17?
You want me to go ahead and read 18 or no?
Oh, is there an 18? Sure. Go ahead. Read 18 if you want to.
Okay.
I'll read out of the... It makes you feel better. No, there is. Sorry.
I'll read out of the New King James Version. And so... Okay. Ecclesiastes 9:11 through 18. I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor the bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding, nor favor to men of skill, but time and chance happen to them all. For man also does not know his time. Like fish taken in a cruel net, like birds caught in a snare, so are the sons of men. So the sons of men are snared in an evil time when it falls suddenly upon them. This wisdom I have also seen under the sun, and it seemed great to me. There was a little city with a few men in it, and a great king came against it, besieged it, and built a great snare around it. Now there was found in it a poor, wise man, and he, by his wisdom, delivered the city, yet no one remembered that same poor man. Then I said, wisdom is better than strength. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are not heard. Words of the wise, spoken quietly, should be heard, rather than the shout of a ruler of fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good.
Okay. There we go. So there's a couple of things here within this reading that I think is really, really interesting. Mm-hmm. Paul, at the beginning there, he does a comparison of several different things there. He talks about the swift, the strong, the wise, the men of understanding, the men of skill. Okay. And he says, like, to regarding the swift, the race is not to the swift. The battle doesn't always go to the strong, bread to the wise, etc. But what he concludes there is, but time and chance happen to them all. When we look at this, we find that when all the work that we do within our life, and I've seen this, and I know you have too, the ones who you would always think would come out on top don't. Okay. This is not the greatest of example, but let's say you've got two people in a foot race and maybe they're running a marathon, just two of them. And one of them is real fast. The other one is really slow and they're within 100 feet of each other, but the swift is going to win and the other one is going to lose. And at that time, the earthquake hits and the ground opens up, then they both die. You know, which one had the advantage? You know, which one walked away saying, hey, I was the winner in this. Now that's not a great of example, but the point is that no matter how strong, no matter how bright, no matter how intelligent, it would seem to us, I would think, that there is no advantage to those things. Would you think that would be a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think here the idea of time and chance happen to them all. Sometimes we want to ascribe a meaning behind every event of life. And you guys may disagree with me on this. Some people say there's a purpose behind everything, or there's a meaning behind everything. And I think that sometimes there's not. It's just time and chance. It's just the wrong timing. I think sometimes you might see, as you mentioned, two people running. One is obviously the favorite. The other one's a huge long shot. And the one wakes up with a stomach flu that morning. You know, and so the slow guy wins. And so I think we need to understand that if we're the smartest, the strongest, the wisest, the richest, the most skilled, doesn't mean that we are just bound and destined for great success. But there are things that happen through the course of life that just are things that happen.
That's a good point. It's interesting, while you were saying that, Mike dropped a comment in. He's having to leave to go do a funeral right now. It's rather, any other thoughts as we go through the section here? I'm not trying to break it down too much, but.
My perspective is a little different. I see part of this. I see any time that he talks about things that are under the sun, Solomon might be describing things that don't have a divine perspective involved. And in other words, under the sun means everything that's visible to the earth. And one of the things that I think he's been saying a lot is that, you know, life's not fair. You know, that he said that several times already. And I think this is that. This is a, you know what I've noticed? That if you're wise, it doesn't mean you're going to be wealthy. And, you know, it's the case that, you know, things just don't always work out. So I might suggest that one way we look at that is within the context of a world that doesn't have a divine revelation. It just seems like everything's random. You know, things just randomly happen. You know, and I got to be careful to say that, you know, Paul's right to say, you know, we want to ascribe meaning to everything. I usually tell people we can't always know meaning. The book of Job is a great example of that, where Job's experiences, God never tells him why he experienced them. God says, you couldn't understand it if I did. I always point to Job's wife and say, you know, Job's wife couldn't understand the things that she experienced, and it wasn't even about her. And so there are things that go on in life that are just so complicated around us that even if God's hand is involved, we probably wouldn't understand it. I kind of think of Mordecai telling Esther, hey, you just don't know that maybe everything happened this way to get you to this moment. You just don't know. And I think Solomon might be speaking more to the idea that there's, you know, without a divine, you know, I know I've said this before and I'll say it again. This is a modernist thought process trying to justify a pre-modernist thinking. In other words, he's saying everything observable means it's chaotic. But if we had a revelation, that's the pre-modernist, we're pre-modernists, you know, the pre-modernist mindset is that, you know, there's a revelation that actually can help make sense of things. And while that doesn't mean everything has an answer that we're going to know, there's a little more confidence to say that there is, you know, there is order in life. It's not as though, you know, time and chance is all that there is. Because sometimes people want to say, well, time and chance, that's everything. Time and chance isn't as though it's some kind of alternative God that has a power. I think we have to have a sense that, you know, the concept of time and chance is probably far less than what Solomon wants us to see. I don't know if I've explained that very well. But again, I think this is more of a contextual statement that without a divine revelation, nothing makes sense.
Right. You know, I have a couple of thoughts building on that. First of all, I think of 1 Corinthians 10:13 or 12. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. You know, we need to beware in life that uncertainty happens. You know, there's an interesting observation to make about time and chance. When you think of a chance is not the normal. A chance is the exception to the rule. And the point that I would make as you're living your life, if as you live your life and you're a 20-something year old, there's a good chance you're going to live another 10 years. Odds are in your favor that you're going to live another 30 years, 40 years, whatever. but there is no guarantee. And you have to live with the realization that there is no guarantee. That's why you cannot be arrogant. And you know, John gave the illustration of the races. You know, we could think of so many different illustrations. And the one that I know we bring this up like a broken record, but I just think it's so relevant now is COVID. You know, think of how the world was going before COVID. Then all of a sudden COVID comes along and that just turned the world upside down. And it just came out of nowhere. And I see that as the point that Solomon is making. You know, as you look at all these things, life happens. And sometimes life is not what should be happening or the standard, but rather it's sometimes there's exceptions to the rules, and we always need to be alert to the fact that those section or those exceptions can happen. And I think the concept also builds in with the latter part of what Paul read, verses 13. We've got this illustration in verses 13 and following, which deals with the wisdom of life and how man doesn't look at things with the proper perspective sometimes. Okay. We have a comment, John?
Yeah, we do. Let me grab that here real quick. This first one's from Danielle. She writes, I agree, Paul. Just like people misuse the scriptures that says, I know the plans I have for you, and that does not mean God has our lives planned out. I think in our own chat here in-house, y'all kind of commented on that. Didn't y'all?
Just mentioned that sometimes people take the passage of Romans 8, where he talks about all things work together. When he's talking about the different aspects of the plan of salvation, sometimes people think, well, that's every event in my life is happening, you know, with God's direction. And, you know, again, we just can't know that.
All right. And then we'll bring in Mike's comment real quick, and then we can talk some more about it. Mike says the following. One more thought. Ecclesiastes 9:11 reads, I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor yet bread to the wise, neither yet bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill, but time and chance happeneth to them all. Does this not prove that regardless of how mortally mighty we might be, God's providence remains and his course of nature doesn't change? The point is we must serve him and allow him to care for us. Good point. Good point. All righty. Let's see. Any other thoughts or comments before we move forward? Any? All right, let me see. Let me get my Bible back up here. Let's see. So 12 goes right along with that. So let's look at the next section here. We read through this a while ago. And in the course of this section, the writer here kind of gives an interesting example of wisdom, but how oftentimes wisdom goes unnoticed, unacknowledged, if we could say something like that. He begins by saying, this wisdom I've also seen under the sun, and it seemed great to me. So he uses this interesting illustration, and I say interesting because if Solomon's the author of this, then he's writing this from a kingly, maybe an older kingly perspective. But you have a small city with a few men in it, and you have a great king who comes against the city and lays siege to the city. Now, in the city there's a poor, wise man. And this, he comes up with a plan. He doesn't tell us what the plan is, but it says, by his wisdom, he delivers the city. Yet no one remembers that poor man. So 50 years later, this mighty king's effort to overthrow this little city was thwarted by this poor little wise man or this poor wise man. But yet no one remembered him for what he had done. Now, any thoughts about the illustrations? I think the following text that we've read will kind of hinge on this particular example here, but any thoughts of that before we go further? I wonder if he saw that as an example, if maybe he had gone up against some small little city thinking he could take it, and it was thwarted by a wise poor man. Well, no, it's just a thought there. But let's go ahead and look at the next section there. So then, with that said, he says, wisdom is better than strength. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are not heard. So you have a comparison there. You have the strength of the mighty king and the power behind the poor man's wisdom. But when it says that it was despised, he's not saying that the people didn't listen to him. It just says that in the aftermath and afterwards, no one gave him credit for what he had done.
Yeah.
Any thoughts? Go ahead. Anybody?
I see the idea of the king here stealing the thunder, and not giving credit where credit is due, and that's one of the vanities of life. You know, that's one of the vanities of putting your trust in mammon, in whatever form it comes in. You know, when God judges, he's going to judge fairly. And he's going to judge you based on you. He's not going to judge you based on others. And so that's one of the vanities of life.
Okay.
I think maybe Ron or Paul. Some of this, what we're reading here, especially beginning around verse 13, might have been better to attach to the next chapter where he goes into because he's contrasting this wise man saving and, you know, nobody really remembers it. And then a fool can do something really terrible, and it's something that you remember all the time. And then he goes into these statements about fools. And I kind of think that those things might all be connected. But one thing that strikes me is that word despised, because I think a lot of times of Esau despising his birthright. And of course, despise means he just has no respect or love for it. That's the significance of that, that he just didn't care much for it. So, you know, in this case, the people despise the wise man just by not caring, by having no respect for it or no honor given to it. And so it's kind of an important idea there.
Okay.
There seems to be a parallelism here. Wisdom is better. Wisdom is better than strength. Wisdom is better than weapons of war. Wisdom is better than strength, but the poor man's wisdom is despised. His words are not heard. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. I think about the situation where the children of Israel were conquering and they were doing great. They were overcoming the land. And who was the man who buried the Babylonian garment? Was that Achan?
Achan
in his tent. And they suffered because of his sin. You know, there's great wisdom, great success. God was guiding them and everything. And you just see that sometimes a very small thing can ruin when everything seems to be going very well. But I like the idea of wisdom is better. And so,
for what it's worth. Did Achan bury in his tent? I remember he buried something from the city of Jericho.
Was it not the Babylonish garment?
The Babylonian garments, yeah. He saw them. He said they were just too beautiful, you know, too beautiful to destroy. So
I may be quoting an older translation.
But they were
Babylonish.
I guess they were Babylonianish, but they were garments of Babylon.
I guess I didn't remember that aspect of it, them specifically being referenced as kind of garments of or attire of garments of Babylon. That's interesting. Okay. All righty. Any thoughts or comments? Oh, I did have one more thought on this. Let me real quick bring this back up here. So the comment I've got or the note on this is not necessarily pertaining to the context of this necessarily. But let me bring the text back up here again real quick. He says, words of the wise spoken quietly should be heard rather than shout of a ruler of fools. You know, it reminds me of the culture we live in today and the number of people who seek to be heard, who are trying to do their best to stand out. And I think that's probably one of the problems of social media today.
Facebook chatting people that are all over, you know, doing their shows on Facebook. Is that?
Yeah. We just got to be seen. But expanding beyond the well-intended righteous people of our group. But when you look at Instagram, you look at Facebook, and I'm guilty of sharing a lot of stuff. I've tried to dial some things back, especially my own political views, kind of pull them back a little bit. But there are people going above and beyond what is acceptable. All right. They're trying to stand out in such a way that it's like they're trying to gain even more attention. And it reminds me a little bit, rather than the shout of a ruler of fools. You know, there's someone who's ruling all these fools, and they're shouting up to support the king. They're shouting up to support this position instead of being the one who's ruled by quiet and wise words. But like I said, the context is different than that application, but kind of brought that to mind. Okay. All right. Let's see. How are we doing? Any thoughts or comments from our chat room? Not yet. I say chat room. That's kind of an old term for our current application. But let's talk about flies and perfumes and a wise man's heart and a fool man's heart. You know, you hear the joke, someone goes into a restaurant and they bring a drink to them, like a coffee or something, because that's what we would drink, you know, I guess, or food, and they find a fly in their food. And the chef says, be quiet, everybody else will want one. Solomon kind of uses the illustration here of a dead fly putrefying, I guess is the word, the perfumer's ointment. And he uses it as an example of, or the comparison to what folly will do in any given situation. So, Tom, I think we're down to you on, or you're up next, I should say, to read. So let's go ahead and break this up a little bit. It's going to be a hard one to break up, but let's go ahead and read verses 1 through 5. No. Let's read verses 1 through 4. That sound good?
Okay. All right. And again, the New King James Version, Ecclesiastes 10, 1 through 4. Dead flies putrefy the perfumer's ointment and cause it to give off a foul odor. So does a little folly to one respected for wisdom and honor. A wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart at his left. Even when a fool walks along the way, he lacks wisdom, and he shows everyone that he is a fool. If the spirit of the ruler rises against you, do not leave your post, for conciliation pacifies great offenses.
Okay, there we go. I may actually change that. For those watching online, I do a side-by-side that now is done a little bit differently, and I may go through and expand the little window where you see the whole Zoom window there to be more true 16:9 so that we can all be on here at one time as we're reading the scriptures. Anyway, so looking at this text, going back, I like the illustration that he begins with, how that you've got a perfumer, he's making his ointment and everything, working on his perfume, the fragranted oil or whatever it may be that he's going to distribute. And in the course of the developmental process, whatever it would involve, a fly lands in it and dies. And the fly ends up putrefying, spoiling. I think the English Standard Version says, gives off a stench. Once he's done, the perfumer's ointment gives off a stench, causes a foul odor. So he compares that to, so does a little folly. And Tom, this is interesting. So does a little folly, just a little bit, to one respected for wisdom and honor. What are your thoughts about that, Tom?
It only takes one sentence to destroy a life's worth of integrity. It only takes one act to set things back. I mean, there may be an exception. There are exceptions. You know, there are people that are forgiving, and there are people that are this or that. But one little statement or one little action can just do so much damage to all the good that somebody has done because it reflects on their character, or people judge their character based on that one act, as opposed to looking at their life as a whole, as opposed to seeing that maybe that one thing is a, you know, it was a glitch, or a slip up, a moment of weakness, a stumble or something. People oftentimes, and this is worldly, and incidentally, as Christians, we're not supposed to do this. You know, as Christians, we ought to step back and look at, you know, look at the whole life and realize that people do stumble. And when I say allow for that, you know what I mean? I'm not saying ignore it, but realize that people are weak and be gracious and be forgiving and so on. But it just takes one thing. It takes one thing to destroy all the good that somebody has done.
And you're right. You know, from a spiritual standpoint, there is forgiveness, for lack of a better way. And I don't even want to say understanding. That's really not the right term, but forgiveness. Okay. If anyone has a complaint with another, you know, forgive one another. Paul writes roughly in his letter to the church at Colossae, I believe it is. But from a very physical standpoint, and this is like a lot of what Solomon's talking about, setting aside spiritual, the nature and the forgiveness and stuff like that. You're right. It doesn't take much to ruin one's reputation. And people remember, they gossip, they talk about it. I mean, I think about David, for an example. Think about how mighty of a man David was as a king all of his life. And now this was more than a little folly, but it might be viewed as such, what happened with Bathsheba and the death of Uriah. But from that point forward, his life, as far as his respect, reputation, was downhill. His family turned against him. His the household was divided. The sword would not depart from his family. We look at Absalom trying to, and he did overthrow David for a short time. But you're right, though. I agree with what you're saying, Tom. It doesn't take much, even for a moment. Any other thoughts on that? I had some.
Incidentally, tying into that, you know, he's dealing with how wisdom is better than other things. You know, I mean, I tie this into verse 18 of the last chapter there. You know, wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. I think it's the warning for us to always strive to be wise. You know, I mean, put your brain in gear before you put your mouth in motion. As far as words go, you know, as an illustration of what we're talking about here. I think Brian had a comment. So,
well, I was going to say, you know, one thing that I find important is to define the idea of what a fool is in these texts, because sometimes in our modern lingual, words like fool, foolishness, folly, they kind of come across as being silly. But in the scriptures, we have a lot of definitions for a fool. In the book of Proverbs, I'm going to throw a few out there. Proverbs 10 and verse 18 says, fools are liars. Proverbs 10:23 says, fools do evil things for sport, for fun. Proverbs 12:15 says that fools rage and they're self-confident, that fools do all sorts of things that are self-destructive. They don't respect wisdom. So it's kind of important for us to say that being a fool isn't the idea of just being silly. It's the idea of not respecting authority, of loving evil, and things like that. I like James, where James says, hey, the wisdom of above is peaceable, gentle, but he says the carnal wisdom, and I think that would be a great definition of foolishness, envy, you know, self-centeredness, things like that. So it's important like that. I just want to add one more thing to exactly what Tom said. How many people have you known, and I fall in this category, that, you know, I remember in high school, I had a good reputation for not using bad language. One day I got really upset about something and I said something and everybody stopped and looked at me and said, oh, okay, all of that work, you know, of trying to set up a good reputation. And that moment I broke it. I knew I broke it. That moment I slipped and said something and I realized, you know, just one slip and it's all lost, you know.
And you know, even if there is grace to be given, after that one slip, how long does it take to repair the damage? I mean, maybe it can be repaired. And incidentally, you know, going along with this, it's kind of a side note to dealing with this. But as brethren, you know, I was listening to a lesson the other day. I sometimes do that when I'm driving distances and so on. And it was dealing with brethren who have failures, you know, and things like that. And the concluding thought that this preacher gave in his sermon is, he said, brethren need to learn to stop gossiping. and it goes back to the fact that sometimes we get in the way of people being able to redeem themselves from a foolish statement. Now, the ultimate goal or the best situation is if you use wisdom and you don't make the statement or don't do the thing in the first place. But when you do, there's a process to get back to it. And of course, here's just the warning about life. This is why wisdom excels folly.
Well, so the next verse says, a wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart at his left. I'm gonna go left for just a minute here with the question, based on what Tom was saying there and related to this. Years ago, I remember someone telling me a situation about a congregation that had an elder. And this elder, at some point in his life, he had an affair on his wife and stepped down. Then years later, I don't know how long, let's say 20 years later, he was reappointed again as an elder. His wife forgave him and everything, but they worked through it. And then 20 years later or something like that, he was appointed as an elder again. And the person telling me the story didn't think he was qualified. Didn't think that he should be serving again as an elder. And I don't know if I have a good answer for that. But that was kind of that situation there, you know. In their mindset, he had been tainted so much by his sin that he never qualified to serve as an elder again. Now, for certain reasons, I don't fully agree with that, the way that I see the teachings of the scriptures and stuff. But in their mind, that mistake, you know, that sin tainted him, for lack of a better word. So, all right, any thoughts or any comments? Okay. Anyone from the comment area? Listen, let us know what you have to think about this. Everybody sitting quietly. I know that you're agreeing with everything that we have to say, and we're covering the vast scope of all things. Not really.
We do have a comment from Jerry Wilcox. And Jerry makes the statement there in our YouTube chat. The James 1:19, which is, go ahead. Sorry, John.
Let me bring that up. And if you've got that handy, Brian, I'll have you, if you would, to read that.
Yeah. He says, could James 1 verse 19, which is the passage that tells us, be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger. Could that apply here? And Jerry, I think that's exactly what it is. In fact, I've often thought that a lot of what James has to say sounds to me a lot like what the Proverbs have to say, you know, about things like favoritism, control. In fact, isn't most of James about controlling your mouth? I've often said that that's the overarching theme of the book of James, control your mouth. And I think that that's really, you know, a great point to say it does fit well here. So,
do you have access to Danielle's comment over on Facebook side?
I do now. Danielle says, Paul killed Christians and he was forgiven. I think she's kind of thinking about what you had said earlier. You know, it's tricky because it does say an elder is to be blameless. But if we define blameless by saying never sinned, the problem is going to be he couldn't be a Christian, because you can't be a Christian unless you have sins to repent of, leading unto the forgiveness of those sins. So blameless is... You know, blameless probably has to have some character understanding there. Daniel's point to say, you know, here, look at Paul. By the way, Paul, that was a terrible thing for you to have done. I think you really need to get your life in order there. So,
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. You know.
Well, going she just back to- complimented me a few moments ago, and now she's. No, I understand. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Tom.
Right. No, I mean, and again, you know, it's interesting. Jerry and Donnell, you've got those are the two sides of the comments that we've been making, or the comment, you know, the observation I made about these things. We do need to learn to forgive, but sometimes that's a struggle because there's damage is done by something said or something done. And it doesn't matter how long, some people just don't want to get over that. And but yet as Christians, it ought to be our goal to get over it. You know, we need to learn to be as gracious as we want God to be to us.
People remember our mistakes.
Oh, yeah.
More than they remember our successes.
Right.
You know, people remember some of my sermons where they were not particularly great. I preached a sermon, and it has to have been, let's see, my wife and I have been married for 32, coming up on 33 years, I think, and I have someone that before we were married, the little church that I was preaching with remembers a sermon that I preached on the sects of the Jews. And I surely could have come up with a better title than SECTS, the sects of the Jews. But he remembers that. Every once in a while, he'll say, "Hey, Paul, I remember that sermon you preached way back when." And, you know, people remember the really awful or less than well presented. But I think that's true with when we make mistakes, if we sin, if we do something out of character, that seems to be more memorable than the good things. I think that he's kind of saying that here, that this foul odor, this disrespect, this fly, there are restaurants that my family will not go to because of things that have been, and I'm not going to say who or give you any indication. There was a restaurant here that someone posted a picture of a worm in the food. And now we don't go there. And it's been a long time. And we still don't go there. It's hard to forget. As Tom mentioned, we ought to be forgiving people. But it's hard to forget bad things. And it's hard to remember sometimes all the good. The elder that you talked about, Tom, I wonder, or John, I wonder what good he may have done in his life. He did this terrible thing, undoubtedly terrible thing, ruined his reputation. And whether he should serve again or not, I don't know the answer to that question. But people couldn't forget it, obviously. So,
well, there are stories, and I'll say it simply like that, accounts of preachers who have done the same thing. And somehow or another, they managed to get back up in the pulpit maybe a year or two later, sometime later, and continue to preach. And some people have no respect for them any longer, but others do. And you've got to be fair about this, because on one hand, it's not an easy thing to forget and forgive. You know, it's not an easy thing to say, well, I'm not going to ever remember what that person did, because every time you see them, for some reason, that may be in your mind. But yet on the other side of the coin, you think to yourself, well, God is already accepting them again. You know, then this now becomes a burden that I have to work within myself to get through this and know that others have had to do the same thing towards me. It's, yeah. There is one more comment that we missed, and I'll read it here real quick. Eileen made the point a little bit earlier that the fool has said in his heart, there is no God, you know, and that Eileen did. And that's a good point. I mean, many times that's the influence of those people in our lives can push us into actions that kind of reflect that mindset, no accountability, you know, and so forth.
You know, what's kind of neat about that, and that goes back to that definition of a fool, is that the fool says it in his heart. He doesn't say it out loud. He just inside thinks, I don't really think that, you know, that God's really out there. And sometimes the term is called practical atheism. You may profess God, but you live your life like there is no God. And I know a lot of people that profess to be Christians, you know, and yet they don't have any respect for God or the word of God or the Christian life. And, you know, there's that practical atheism of a fool. He says there's a God, but in his heart, he doesn't really.
Yeah, that's a good point. Brendan in the chat room sent in just a simple reference to Matthew 6, 11 through 15. Brendan, who is unusually absent from our study today, you know, he's out helping somebody and being a nice person. And so that's why he's not with us today. Anyway, he points us over to Matthew 6 and verses 11 through 15 or 9 through 15, where Jesus is talking to his apostles about prayer. And in the course of that prayer, he reminds them there that they are supposed to, or as he says in the prayer, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And then he goes on to say that for if you forgive men their trespasses, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. And the inverse is true. If you do not forgive men their trespasses, neither will your Father forgive your trespasses. So it's a good connecting point with that, Brendan. I appreciate that.
Right, right. You know, and we'll have a discussion with Brendan about priorities when the show is over. Just think about this, John. One action has its consequences.
You know, last week we didn't have our study because I helped my son change his brakes. That was far more important than whatever Brendan's doing today. Just keep that in mind. No, actually, Brendan's helping someone who needed help moving, and so we completely understand that. All right, let's see. Why don't we plan to go ahead and pause the study for today, and let's continue next Thursday with chapter 10, verse 3. There's a few more things we need to talk about in the context of the first four verses that'll help us as we flow into verse 5 and following. It's not a good point. Stopping point, I guess. Okay. Well, listen, let me take a moment. Thank you, everyone, for joining us for our study today. I really appreciate, we all appreciate your comments. And listen, if you think of something later as you go back and you're pondering the wisdom of Solomon, not our wisdom, but the wisdom of Solomon, if you have a question or something you want to touch base with us about, do that. You can send it to, bring the ticker back up there. For some reason, it dropped away. questions@truthfactorlive.com or reach out via social media. You'll see our various handles that way. We would love to hear from you. We'll definitely do our best to either get back with you or bring it into next week's study. All right, gentlemen, I guess that's all for now. So we'll see everyone next week as we continue our study through the book of Ecclesiastes. All right, everyone say bye. We'll see y'all later. Y'all have a wonderful week. Bye-bye.